Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Dr. Robert Rosner, chair of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists Science and Security Board, who assesses the consequences of the U.S. withdrawal from the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty with Russia. Bettina Hager, Washington director of the ERA Coalition, who discusses the history of the Equal Rights Amendment and the current national campaign to ratify the ERA as an amendment to the U.S. Constitution. And Lori Martin and Caleb Martin Mooney, founders of Haven's Harvest, who talk about their Connecticut-based food recovery and distribution program. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
More than 25,000 Mexicans working in maquiladoras factories south of Brownville, Texas, went on strike on January the 25th, seeking a 20% pay hike and a $1,500 bonus from factory owners. The strike closed dozens of auto, medical equipment, and plastics factories that were manufacturing goods for export to the United States. The strikes were centered in the town of Matamoros, where workers claim factory owners withheld promised bonuses in the aftermath of a minimum wage increase to $9 an hour in border states, announced by newly sworn-in Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador. Mexican labor lawyer Susana Prieto told In These Times magazine that workers' earnings in Matamoros have plummeted 50% over the last 22 years. Export industry leaders complained that, because of the strike, their factories were losing $50 million a day in unfulfilled contracts. Kathy Stewart, a retired professor at the University of Texas, El Paso, observed that the militancy in the maquiladoras reflects years of frustration over both low pay and a steep increase in the cost of living in border communities. Among Mexican progressives, the wildcat strikes in the maquiladoras are seen as an early test for President López Obrador's fourth transition program to reduce inequality and to build a new partnership between the government, corporations, and workers. Arab states, including Saudi Arabia, disagree with the US and European Union on how to re-engage with Syrian leader Bashar al-Assad. Arab states, specifically Jordan, are meeting with top Syrian officials to negotiate construction contracts to rebuild the battle-scarred country. Meanwhile, security officials from Persian Gulf nations and the Arab League are in dialogue with Syria after years of backing armed rebel groups. According to the Christian Science Monitor, Arab states are now lobbying the EU and the Trump administration to ease sanctions on Assad's regime to encourage more foreign investment. Arab states are motivated by what they see as the urgent need to counter Iran's growing influence in Syria and the broader Middle East. Moreover, Syria remains regionally important because the nation is the only overland route to Europe for Jordan, Lebanon, and the Arab Gulf states. However, sanctions imposed against Assad's Syrian government by the US and EU could impede rebuilding plans. The US Senate is now considering establishing additional sanctions against foreign companies or individuals who do business with Syria. Ironically, new Western sanctions could open the door for Russia and China to fund their own rebuilding contracts in Syria, leaving the US and EU on the sidelines. U.S. Senator Kamala Harris launched her 2020 presidential bid before a crowd of 20,000 cheering supporters in her hometown of Oakland, California. The African-American senator, who is the daughter of immigrant parents, served as California's state attorney general. Harris' long record as attorney general and as a San Francisco prosecutor from 2004 to 2011 has provoked criticism on the left for her failure to investigate aggressively allegations of misconduct and abuse by police and prosecutors, even in the face of clear evidence of wrongdoing. Harris defended harsh prison sentences, appealed a court ruling that overturned the state's death penalty, and implemented policies that criminalized truancy, targeting parents in historically black and Latino neighborhoods. According to the Guardian newspaper, Harris never responded to requests from San Francisco public defender Jeff Adachi to open a civil rights investigation of a string of high-profile police killings of young people of color and of officers caught sending racist and homophobic text messages. As Attorney General, Harris spent years defending injustices in California's troubled and overcrowded prison system, taking positions at odds with some of her current policy positions as a senator. As the writer of a recent editorial stated, if Kamala Harris wants to have people vote for her who care about dismantling mass incarceration and correcting miscarriages of justice, she needs to break radically with her past. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Nigel Victor Rees.
Following earlier warnings from the White House, the Trump administration announced that the United States will suspend its obligations under the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, or INF, ending participation in a key arms control agreement between the U.S. and Russia. Washington's withdrawal, which was followed by Moscow's own announcement suspending INF treaty compliance, takes effect in 6 months. President Trump charged that the Russians are violating the terms of the 1987 INF Treaty by building and deploying an intermediate-range cruise missile, the SSC-8, which they say exceeds the treaty's range limitation of 310 to 3,420 miles. The Russians counter that the U.S. has breached the agreement by deploying an anti-missile system in Eastern Europe, as well as armed drones that can be used offensively against their nation. With the U.S. withdrawal from the INF Treaty and earlier decisions to exit from the Iran International Nuclear Agreement and Paris Climate Accord, the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists set its doomsday clock at 2 minutes to midnight due to the rising twin threats of nuclear conflict and climate change. Your reporter spoke with Dr. Robert Rosner, chair of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists Science and Security Board, who assesses the consequences of the U.S. withdrawal from the INF Treaty, which could jeopardize renewal of the New START Treaty that limits the number of U.S. and Russian nuclear warheads and delivery systems, which expires in 2021.
New START, the treaty that replaced the original START Treaty, was a deal that we cut with the Russians to limit the number of strategic nuclear weapons to 1,550 maximum on each side. It turns out that there has never been an agreement to limit the number of tactical or battlefield nuclear weapons. Currently, there is no limit on those whatsoever. And one of the tremendous concerns that many of us have about stepping out of the intermediate missile agreement is that those missiles included tactical nuclear weapons. For example, the United States used to station Pershing 2 missiles in Europe, in Germany, and these are missiles that have a fairly short range. They fell under the INF Treaty, and the rules of engagement for them was rather different than the rules of engagement for the Minuteman missiles, so the submarine-launched missiles. They're more on hair trigger, they're more under local control, and the response time is extremely short. Many of them, from launch to target, fly something of the order of 10, 15 minutes. So you don't have much time. If you make a mistake, you don't have much time to do much about that. And that's the concern. And the idea that there are no numerical limits in any treaty whatsoever on those really makes us worried that we will, in fact, have, again, a spiraling up of an arms race with new nuclear weapons, new delivery vehicles installed over the next few years. That is a major worry, yes.
Dr. Rosner, who benefits from the Trump administration and now Russia pulling out of this INF nuclear missile treaty, apart from the defense contractors who may get a lot of money to build a new generation of nuclear weapons? Who's going to benefit from this?
Well, I must say it's very hard to see who benefits. I think your listeners probably remember that the president who, under whose aegis these missiles were limited in the first place, was, of course, Ronald Reagan. And nobody would ever think of accusing Ronald Reagan of being soft on national defense. So I think he understood perfectly well that just multiplying the number of these weapons over and over again simply does not make rational sense. And if one looks carefully at the Trump administration's argument for withdrawing from the treaty, it's based on the assertion that the Russians have already violated the treaty. So if they violated it, we should just pull out. And of course, the Russians have denied that. Now, there are a number of ways of going about this. One way is to go back to the negotiation table and have it out at the negotiating table. The other way is the way it's being done, which is simply withdrawal. Currently, we are not negotiating with the Russians whatsoever on the official level. And that is definitely, we think, that's really problematic.
How can citizens effectively take action to prevent a costly and very dangerous new nuclear arms race from developing between the United States and Russia at this point?
Well, you know, we've been here before, and the public played an enormous role in this. I think citizens, what we see as an issue here in the United States is that I think not enough people understand the pickle that we're in. We in the Bulletin call this the new abnormal. We've somehow managed to not realize that we slipped into a state in which we really should be concerned about the number of weapons out there, the state of our relations as a country with our former adversaries who are becoming adversaries once again, and that we're heading into a time of enormous international instability, armed to the teeth. And as citizens, we have an ability to speak out. This happened during the Cold War. It happened during Vietnam. I think the United States is lucky to have a citizenry that once it perceives that there is a problem, it does get politically engaged, and the politicians will follow. So it's very important for folks to first educate themselves on the current situation, and then if they perceive that there's a problem, to actually join appropriate groups that will further their goals, their political goals. I think that's very important.
That was Dr. Robert Rosner, chair of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists Science and Security Board, and William E. Rather Distinguished Service Professor in the Departments of Astronomy and Astrophysics at the University of Chicago. Find more analysis and commentary on the erosion of nuclear arms control agreements by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The proposed Equal Rights Amendment to the U.S. Constitution reads as follows. Equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. First proposed in 1921, the ERA didn't gain traction until the amendment was approved by the House in 1971 and the Senate in 1972. But in subsequent years, with the extension of the original time limit from 1979 to 1982, only 35 of the required 38 states ratified the amendment. Conservative opponents succeeded in eroding support for the ERA by arguing that with its ratification, women would be drafted into the military and lose protections in divorce cases and child custody rulings. But over the last few years, the movement to ratify the ERA has gained new momentum. In 2017, Nevada's state legislature ratified the ERA, followed by the Illinois legislature in 2018. Only one state short of the mandated 38, Virginia's Senate approved the amendment, while a subcommittee of the state's House of Delegates blocked the measure. Advocates are now focused on gaining passage in North Carolina and Arizona. Your reporter spoke with Bettina Hager, Washington Director and Chief Operating Officer of the ERA Coalition. Here she talks about the history of the Equal Rights Amendment and the current national campaign to ratify the ERA.
Every single year, the Equal Rights Amendment has been introduced in Congress since 1982. So there have always been people who've continued to work on this issue because it's so important to our country and it's also personally important to many advocates. But there was no kind of central base to help organize in a way that could, you know, effectively be used to create a national movement. And 4.5 years ago or so, I was already working on this issue as the co-chair of the ERA Task Force, the National Council of Women's Organizations. And basically, Congresswoman Maloney, who's been a longtime congressional advocate for the Equal Rights Amendment, approached Jessica Neuwirth, who is the co-founder of the ERA Coalition, and said, you know, we really need a national constituency if we're going to ever get this ratified into the U.S. Constitution. And as an amendment to the Constitution, there needs to be kind of a full-time focus on passing an amendment because it takes two-thirds of the House and the Senate to pass it through Congress and then three-quarters of the states to ratify it. So Jessica and two of our other co-founders really kind of recognize this need to have a central place sort of bringing all of the advocates who are either kind of in the states and have continued to fight since 1982 and kind of do the legwork and, you know, really organize a national movement and create the ability to bring it to the national stage.
Bettina, I wanted to ask you about public opinion. Have we seen any recent polls that would indicate the acceptance of the public today in 2019 of your effort to push for the adoption of the ERA amendment?
Absolutely. We had a poll that we commissioned in 2015, released in 2016, where the poll showed that there was about 94% of the respondents believe that the U.S. Constitution should be amended to require equal rights for men and women. So our polling company, when we talked to them and they showed us these results, said you couldn't even get that level of support for everyone agreeing that we should all drink water. You know, they said they've never seen anything that high. It's really kind of an unprecedented poll. They were just astounded. Really, there's nothing that has that high of an approval rating. The issue, though, is that there is what I like to call an information gap. That same poll showed that 80% of the respondents mistakenly believed that equal rights on the basis of sex already exist in our Constitution. And one of the things I kind of always point out is that, you know, if you believe you have something, you're not going to work to get it because you don't know that you need to. So one of the main things that we as a coalition and one of the reasons that it was so important to create this national constituency was that we can reach more people. We have a constituency that we can give this information to, that we can, you know, try to let them know that we still need to be fighting for this. Because until we have higher numbers of people knowing that we do not currently have an equal rights amendment in the Constitution, it will be very difficult to change the tide.
Bettina, just a final question here. In your mind, what is the urgency to get the ERA passed as soon as possible, given that we have Donald Trump as president, who's certainly shown his colors as a longtime misogynist, as is important sectors of the Republican Party? We also have the Me Too movement at the moment and a conservative majority on the U.S. Supreme Court with a very controversial confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh and all the accusations and allegations leveled at him in his past. Maybe you could explain the urgency of this moment in terms of the ERA and its necessity to pass quickly.
I think every single reason that you just listed is a reason that there is such a high urgency right now. I think that there's an urgency both socially and legally to see the Equal Rights Amendment passed and ratified in our U.S. Constitution. And they go hand in hand. One of the things that has been really highlighted by this new administration is the fact that legislation can be easily rolled back with a majority vote of the House and the Senate. And that all of the hard-won rights that our foremothers have put into place to allow women of my generation to really have a lot of opportunities to succeed in the society can be rolled back. A constitutional amendment cannot be rolled back. Once a constitutional amendment is ratified, it's there forever. women shouldn't be afraid that an election will determine their rights. They should be completely confident that they'll always be there.
That was Bettina Hager, Washington Director and Chief Operating Officer of the ERA Coalition. Find more news and commentary on the current drive to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Nationwide, it's estimated that between 30 and 40% of food grown in the U.S. is wasted, while millions go hungry. Moreover, the environmental impact of food production is second only to the burning of fossil fuels in generating greenhouse gas emissions that are wrecking the climate. As these statistics have become better known, more people have taken action to reduce food waste from seed to dining table. One such project in New Haven, Connecticut, began as a family-run operation more than 3 years ago. Haven's Harvest, as it's known, just had its formal kickoff in late January at an event that brought together volunteers and some of the agencies they serve. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus attended the coming-out party for Haven's Harvest, which was founded by Lori Martin, who's involved her homeschooled children in the project as drivers, schedulers, and tech gurus. In its 3 years of operation, the soon-to-be certified nonprofit has recruited scores of volunteers who've rescued 768,000 pounds of food, providing more than 500,000 meals to individuals and families in need. After the group's recent kickoff, Tuhu spoke with Martin and her son Caleb Martin Mooney at their home, where they talked about their food recovery and distribution program.
We started a Trader Joe's run 5 days a week, I think, initially, and it was the two of us.
So now you have this empire of food rescue where you have 148 volunteers and you have pretty much an exact match of food donors and food receiving sites. 78 food donors, 77 receiving sites. And I think that's not an accident, right, Lori?
Those numbers came up organically, but it turns out that that is our magic ratio, is 2 to 1 to the other site. So 2 volunteers to sort of receiving sites and donors. And as we take on food donors, then we look around that area to keep the food in a tight radius and find new receiving sites. And that's what we've done. We initially, with Caleb, before the church story, is that we thought we would reach out to places that are traditional places of where people in need food, so soup kitchens and food pantries. And we were so surprised that those folks weren't open to taking the food from Trader Joe's. It didn't fit their model of feeding folks. It didn't fit their needs exactly because the quantities were unknown and inconsistent. So then we realized, like, oh, this food is still amazing, and we need to find a way to share it. And so that's how we began to look for faith communities.
What kind of food were you packing into your vehicle every day?
So from Trader Joe's specifically, we rescue massive trash bags full of bread, and we will get maybe 5 to 8 trash bags every time we go. Usually, depends. Obviously, it's inconsistent. So that's a huge amount of bread that we get. We also get pastries and sushi.
Oh, produce and meat and dairy. We get all the food that as it either didn't sell quickly because they have a quick turnover model, or things that have just come to their dates for sale by dates. We get all of that. And so we initially thought we would get about 15 cases of food per day, but on average, we get about 22 cases. And then these large bags packed with different kinds of bread products. It could be tortillas and muffins, English muffins, bread, all sorts of things. One of the questions that has come up is, you know, is our mission, or at least in the last few years, is our mission to feed poor people or is it to recover food? And at the time, I would always say that it's difficult to say which is true, because certainly New Haven has such great disparities economically that I definitely wanted people who didn't have good access and convenient and consistent access to food to get it, get this great food that we were recovering. And I'm totally passionate about the environment, around the environment, and I don't think food should be wasted. So at this point, though, with the launch of Haven's Harvest, it is definitely an environmental mission. So our mission is to recover food so that good food doesn't get wasted. And then the byproduct of that is that people get fed.
In 2018, there was over 750,000 pounds of food was recovered in the greater New Haven area. I was going to ask about that. So not just the city, but the surrounding towns as well. And just over 400,000 pounds of CO2 emissions prevented. People might wonder, well, how is recovering food preventing CO2 emissions?
So if we look at the food recovery pyramid that the USDA and the EPA put out a number of years ago, at the top of the food pyramid is to simply reduce the food produced, right, so that you're not producing acres and acres and acres, perhaps, of food that will never get used. And the next part of that, of sort of reducing the food waste, is to feed people. And then below that is feed animals, and then next is make fuel. After that is making compost. And the last thing that gets done with food is to throw it away. I mean, the way I see the food, excess food in all sorts of forms, is that it's a resource. And so if we do nothing with it and it ends up in the landfill, then we are creating a huge environmental problem. So to do anything above in those steps, compost, fuel, feed animals or people, we're doing something and considering it and recognizing it as a resource. So when it ends up, like other things, when it ends up in the landfill, having done nothing good with it, then it becomes a huge hazard. And that's where it's producing CO2 emissions, but also methane. So methane gets produced just like cows produce methane. We produce methane. So it gets produced when it sits in the landfill. And then landfills, we don't necessarily capture that methane to produce fuel.
Are you hooked in at all to a national movement for food recovery? Because I know this happens in other places.
I mean, we do in that we are still using the app and are still partners with Food Rescue US. And they now have about 17 sites or so around the country. And so there is sort of tapping in to the information and wisdom that we're all gaining as we do the work.
That was Lori Martin and her son Caleb Martin Mooney, founders of Haven's Harvest Food Recovery Program. Learn more about Haven's Harvest and similar programs across the U.S. by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on Radio Helsinki in Graz, Austria, WDRT in Viroqua, Wisconsin, KMXT in Kodiak, Alaska, and dozens of other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Nigel Victor Reese, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.